I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New York. It's Here and Now.
Russian officials are now saying more than 100 people could be dead after a hostage situation in southern Russia ended in gunfire and explosions. Russian soldiers stormed the school in Beslan this morning, where armed militants were holding hundreds of children and adults hostage. Yana Delugi of Agence France-Presse is in Beslan. We've reached her there. Yana, you've just returned from the hospital. Can you describe the scene there for us?
The scene at the hospital was as chaotic as the scene throughout the town all day. There are hundreds of relatives gathered in front of the entrance where the ambulances are pulling up. Dozens of people at one point or another are gathered around the handwritten lists of victims who have been brought into the hospital, straining up to see the names of their loved ones. At one corner, all of the children that are brought in and adults are being put on green stretchers on the lawn outside. Some children were waiting to be claimed by their parents. I saw one little girl who was wailing, "Where's my mommy? Where's my mommy?" And there was a couple of strangers basically trying to calm her down. A few dozen women were in another corner wailing about because their children and grandchildren or nieces and nephews had died.
Oh, you are now back at the school area in Beslan. What's the situation? Are the Russian forces in control there now?
Well, they're not letting us near the building. What we're hearing, in the past 10 minutes, we've heard very powerful explosions coming from the building, and these have been frequent along with automatic gunfire for the past since about 4 o'clock when the main battle had died down. And the supposition here is that they're demining the place because the hostage takers did, according to reports, mine the perimeter of the school. So that's what we're assuming the Russians are doing right now.
What are you hearing now about the possibility that some of the hostage takers may have escaped or holed up elsewhere in the town?
We haven't heard too much about that. Immediately following the battle, there's hundreds of people, hundreds of residents, very angry residents outside. And at one point, one man with a beard appeared, and I don't know how it happened, but people thought that he was one of the hostage takers, and they just started beating him, and he was basically close to being lynched. And somehow the police and soldiers, they dragged him into a police station, as he was being followed by this mob ready to tear him to pieces. I went to the hospital after that, but from what I can understand, there were some photographers here saying that apparently he was not a rebel. He was just a townsperson who had a beard, and for some reason or another, things to come from on.
It's just been such a horrible 2 days, an anxious time. It sounds like tempers and emotions are running very high. Do you have any idea at this point what the human cost of this siege will be?
It's very, very difficult to say because from the beginning we've had, we didn't have an exact figure of how many people were inside the school. The officials were saying between 3 and 4. They started saying 120, then they went up to 4. Early this morning, before the storming had begun, the president of the North Ossetia, where all of this is taking place, is the Russian Republic, said that there was probably more than 500. Meanwhile, residents were telling us that, no, they're lying, there's at least 900 or 1,000 people inside there because the school had grades from 1 to 11, and there were also a lot of parents and adults there because in Russia, on 1st of September, which is when this all took place, it's a very festive day, and especially for first graders, their whole families come with flowers and, brothers, sisters, grandparents, aunts, uncles. So we never had a figure for how many people were inside, so it's very difficult to say how many people may have died as a result of this.
Okay, just briefly here, Yana, we saw so many pictures this morning of children in their underwear guzzling water on stretchers. Do we know anything about the conditions under which they were held?
I talked to One 15-year-old who was held there, and I talked to several adults. They told me that they were not allowed to go to the bathroom frequently. The girl said they were allowed to go once a day, but then everybody crowded around the bathroom, so
and not
shot into the air.
And no food and no water. Yana, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Yana Dulugi is with Agence France-Presse. She is in Beslan.
President George Bush and Senator John Kerry are campaigning today in two swing states. We'll have more on that later. But first, President Bush accepted his party's nomination last night. He spoke of the nation's resolve after 9/11 and of his own swift response to Saddam Hussein. Joining us is Terrence Samuels, chief congressional reporter for U.S. News and World Report. Terrence, you know, the partisan crowd inside loved it, with the exception of at least three protesters. But what struck you?
What struck me was how well written the speech was, and how closely the president stuck to the script. This was the speech that people thought he had to make, and he did it. For the most part, it was what conventions have become. They pep rallies, and he needed to rally the faithful, and he did.
And one of the topics that he struck most was the military. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad so we do not have to face them here at home.
Terrence, he also called this the Liberty Century, and people are wondering, what does that mean? Is that a clue to future preemptive invasions?
Well, nobody knows what it means. That's going to be part of the debate. The president, this speech, this presidency, and clearly this election is... It's firmly rooted in the idea that we are at war with terrorists, and that nothing much else matters. The president, even when he talks about the economy, he talks about it in the context of the security of a growing economy. It's going to be the touchstone and the capstone of this campaign, and he talked about the expansion of liberty as a security issue.
That perseverance and resolve were the other two words. And I don't know about you, Terrence, but we couldn't find many New Yorkers who didn't hate the constant coupling of 9/11 and Iraq.
Well, you know, this is one of the president's problems over the last few months, and one that some people thought he needed to answer the question about how do you explain Iraq, even when everybody agrees with you that there was some necessity to respond to 9/11. The way he's gone about it is to say that the war in Iraq is the war on terrorism, and the war on terrorism is at the heart of the national debate because of 9/11. There are people who didn't like it much. As you know, there was one protester who was actually wearing a pink slip, saying that Bush should get the pink slip.
Terrence, we're actually going to talk more about the economy later in the program, but definitely the military and the economy were the messages to get across last night. And that one line, he said, people say I swagger. We call that walking. Terrence,
yeah,
thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us. We've run out of time because of breaking news. Thank you. Terrence Samuels, chief congressional reporter for U.S. News and World Report.
The terrorism case against four men in Detroit is over. Yesterday, a federal judge in Detroit said prosecutors simply ignored or avoided evidence that pointed to the innocence of the men. So the judge dismissed the charges. The Justice Department had originally hailed the case as a victory in the war on terror. Joining us on the line is Jonathan Turley, a professor at George Washington University Law School. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
These men involved in this case are Arab American. They were arrested just days after 9/11. I think we all know that was a very anxious time. They were accused of having things like surveillance videos and some information about sensitive sites, but I'm going to quote from what the judge said yesterday. He said the prosecution's zeal overcame their professional judgment. Is this an isolated case, do you think?
Unfortunately, I don't think it is an isolated case. First of all, the judge in the case, Gerald Rosen, really I think, symbolizes, as do some other judges in the last few years, the value of the American courts in standing up for individual rights. Judge Rosen was extremely mad when he'd found that evidence had been concealed that indicated that these men may have actually been up to nothing at all, and that there was a knowing effort by the Department of Justice to conceal evidence that was exculpatory. We've seen this in other cases where the Department of Justice has really forgotten the means and is focused only on the ends. And I think that's a cultural thing.
Well, can we put this particular case in some sort of perspective here? Because we did have a recent report from Attorney General John Ashcroft of the number of defendants charged in this war on terror. Tell us about that.
Well, Ashcroft every year has been releasing figures that he insists show success in combating terrorism. In reality, there's less than meets the eye in these reports. When we look at these cases, we often find they're not national security cases. For example, in one report, 65 cases that were garden variety immigration violations were included as terrorism cases simply because they involved Middle Eastern men. And we've also seen them claim as terrorism cases, for example, a prosecution of Greenpeace for simply boarding a mahogany wood ship, which was treated as a national security case. It was ultimately thrown out. So there's a certain body count culture that's come out of the Ashcroft Justice Department, and prosecutors are being encouraged to bring those numbers up in the same way as we had a body count culture in Vietnam.
And that somehow the body count was an indication of how the United States was winning the war in Vietnam, and yet it wasn't. Do you draw the same parallel here?
Yes, and that's the reason I've drawn the parallel to Vietnam in past writings, in that the Department of Defense found that their body count approach led to the excessive use of force and often misleading reports. The same has taken hold in the Department of Justice. There's been an excessive use of indictments. Prosecutors have cut corners, in some cases done grossly unethical things. The FBI has been accused of gross abuses in terms of detainees. And I think that all comes out of this culture in the Ashcroft Justice Department.
Well, the one thing that the Justice Department has says is that the system is able to fix itself, like that it did come to the fore. It was considered in court, and the charges against the men, the terrorism charges at least, have been dropped.
Well, I have to say that I find that perfectly laughable. As an independent observer, the Detroit case was unraveling almost from the beginning. There were challenges to the evidence. Ashcroft was fully aware of these allegations, and yet they pushed for a conviction. And they only threw in the towel because they had to. Judge Rosen had made it perfectly clear that he was going to hold people accountable. And it's amazing to me that the Justice Department has touted this as somehow a redeeming moment. They didn't just have a gun at their head. They had a gun at their head and a noose around their neck when they finally admitted that they had done wrong.
Jonathan, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a professor at George Washington University Law School.
Just ahead, onward to Pennsylvania and Ohio. What are the issues that'll make or break a campaign in those states?
And later in the show, President Bush spoke of an ownership society last night. What does that mean for Social Security and health care?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New York. It's Here and Now.
George Bush and John Kerry are wasting no time now that the Republican National Convention is history. This morning, President Bush held a rally near Scranton, Pennsylvania.
With your help, your state of Pennsylvania will be a significant reason we are reelected for 4 more years.
Minutes after President Bush finished his convention speech last night, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry held a rally in Springfield, Ohio. He lashed out after a month of attacks from conservatives calling him unfit for command.
Let me tell you in no uncertain terms what makes someone unfit for office and unfit for duty. Misleading our nation into war in Iraq makes you unfit.
along with Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, among the most contested electoral backgrounds. And pundits say the man who wins two out of those three states wins the election. Joining us on the line are Brad Linder. He covers politics for NPR member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Hello, Brad.
Hello, Jennifer.
And Bill Cohen covers politics for Ohio Public Television and Radio. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
Brad, if I can start with you, give us a snapshot of where the race now stands in Pennsylvania.
Well, Pennsylvania is, of course, a key swing state, and the candidates have not forgotten that once. George Bush is on his 34th visit to Pennsylvania today since he took office years ago. And John Kerry and John Edwards have been swinging through the state. John Edwards was here yesterday in advance of the president's speech to the convention. There's 21 electoral votes in this state, and it's a state that voted for Al Gore in the 2000 election, but could really go either way in this election. The latest polls have a dead heat at about 45% to 44%, with Bush slightly ahead. But that's within the margin of error, so nobody really knows how Pennsylvania is going to go this year.
Bill, how about Ohio?
Well, no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio. That's the factoid everybody here keeps reciting. It's why Bush and Kerry both have been here. Bush has been here 20 times since he was elected. Kerry has been here 20 times just since February. Ohio keeps switching back and forth. You know, Ohio generally goes with the winner, and that's why everybody is campaigning here.
This next week is going to be quite busy in terms of ads run in swing states like yours. Interestingly enough, after the focus this week at the Republican National Convention on things like the war on terror, these ads are expected for both sides to focus on domestic issues. And, Brad, I have to think in Pennsylvania that that's number one in a lot of voters' minds.
Oh, it absolutely is. In fact, that's the message we've been hearing from a lot of candidates. Yesterday, John Edwards rallied in Pennsylvania in suburban Philadelphia, Norristown, an economically depressed seat of the Montgomery County Capitol. And this is an area that generally has more Republicans than Democrats, but because of the financial hard times, a lot of people are very concerned about issues of health care, of overtime, of working class issues. And in fact, last night, organized labor in Pennsylvania was trying to send 500 people out door to door. I'm not sure if they got the full 500, but definitely I met with some members of labor who are going to knock door to door of other labor households and tell people how important this election is because of issues like the recent overtime bill.
And Bill, in Ohio, one of the things that we've been talking about with John Kerry so much in recent weeks is his record in Vietnam, but surely President Bush's record on things like jobs and the economy are going to be playing big in Ohio.
Yes, you're right. That's why Democrats think they have a shot at Ohio, because as they keep saying, we've lost 200,000 jobs since Bush took office. Labor union folks are going to be doing the same thing that you just heard they're going to be doing in Pennsylvania. They are going to be going door to door. They've just launched that in the last day or two.
Brad, in Pennsylvania, is there reaction to the sort of ugly turn that that the campaign took a bit of in New York at the convention? We had a Democrat speaking for the Republican, Zell Miller from Georgia, that even some Republicans were trying to distance themselves from a bit. And I'm curious about how that kind of tone you think might affect voters in Pennsylvania. Does it grab them or does it put them off?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say what the overall reaction from the convention is going to be. But again, yesterday during his speech, John Edwards did poke fun at the Republican convention. He said something to the effect of, well, there's a lot of optimism and enthusiasm coming out of there, sarcastically. And that did get a very big laugh out of several hundred people.
Bill Cohen in Ohio, one of the things that Zell Miller said after his speech that raised several eyebrows was he wished he could have challenged John Kerry to a duel. And I'm wondering what you think, when we're talking about tone and perhaps a more negative tone, if that affects turnout in Ohio, what effect is that going to have on who gets the lead, do you think?
That's just so hard to tell. I can just tell you, as you say, turnout really is going to be the key. I don't think either side is going to be lax in turnout this time. I think both sides are really charged up, mainly because it's so neck and neck in Ohio. The latest Columbus Dispatch poll put Kerry and Bush both, not just a virtual tie, but an actual tie, 46% supporting each candidate, a couple of points for Nader. You really have only about 4 or 5% of the voters who are still undecided. So all these comments from at the convention, all the millions of dollars of TV ads, all these appearances in the last couple months of the campaign, it's really just geared at trying to convince that very small group of voters to come over to Kerry's side or Bush's side.
And if I could jump in on that, less than 10% of voters in Pennsylvania have said that they haven't made up their mind yet. So it's not even a question, I think, at this point of going door to door and trying to knock on people's doors. It's a question of getting people to the polls.
But it's not just, both candidates playing to their base. We're also starting to see them actually go into enemy territory a little bit. We had Bush come into Youngstown and Cleveland here in Ohio, Democratic strongholds. And today I'm here in Licking County, just east of Columbus, as Kerry is going to be here talking to some unemployed workers and doing a courthouse rally. And this is a very conservative county. It went for Bush by 22 points in the year 2000. Here we have Kerry really in enemy territory today.
Thank you both for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Bill Cohen is a reporter for the State House News Bureau in Ohio. Brad Linder is a reporter for NPR member station WHYY in Philadelphia. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New York. It's Here and Now.
The economy added 144,000 jobs in August. That was better than July, but still far short of what economists would call a fully recovered labor market. The unemployment rate did fall a tenth of a point to 5.4%.
The highly anticipated job numbers came at the end of a week of celebration by the Republican Party here in New York. Last night, President Bush outlined in broad strokes his second-term domestic agenda. He called for simplification of the federal tax code and for changes to health care funding. And nearly 4 years after he pledged to privatize Social Security, last night the president promised again.
We must strengthen Social Security by allowing younger workers to save some of their taxes in a personal account, a nest egg you can call your own and government can never take away.
The president called his agenda the Ownership Society. But what does the Ownership Society of George W. Bush mean? And is it a good idea? And with a $400 billion federal deficit, 1 million jobs lost, and 4 million Americans sliding below the poverty line during the Bush presidency, is the president's plan the right one for America right now? We're joined by Eric Engen, an economist at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Rob, and good afternoon.
And also Ted Marmer, professor of public policy and management at Yale University. Hi, Ted.
Hi.
Well, let's see where you both stand on what to some people is one of the most critical issues. In calling for this personal Social Security account last night, the president didn't specify how that money would be invested, but it's assumed by many that people would put that portion of the Social Security in stocks and bonds. Eric, to you first. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I think that personal accounts are an integral component of Social Security reform to do two things. One, to deal with the aging population that we're going to have, which is going to put the great financial stress on Social Security. And two, you can think of these individual accounts as kind of the most effective lockbox. It's a way to get savings off of the government books, and thus policymakers can't use it to finance other types of spending. That's the primary benefit of personal accounts, and that increased saving will help the economy in general in terms of providing funds for capital and investment, which will make the economy stronger and help us deal with the overall challenges of an aging economy.
Well, Ted Marmer, as you know, that's the president's thinking. What's yours?
Oh, mine is completely opposite to that. Let me just make 2 points. One is this program of individual accounts will do nothing about an aging society. That is, it doesn't change the number of aging, doesn't change the number of retired people one bit. So that's the first point. And the second one, I think, is a more ironic one, is after all, the proposal is to take part of what in effect are government taxes, your contributions to Social Security, and then tell people you take this part of the tax funds and you invest that in individual accounts in which you bear the risk. I mean, I think the analogy would be if a father told a child to take the savings and have them go to a casino. The one thing we know about the stock market is that putting money in the stock market is not a source of security. It may be a source of potential gain, but it's not a source of security. And that, it seems to me, is the rhetorical misrepresentation of last night.
Well, you have pretty much outlined the two different camps on Social Security. So let's move on to health care. The president called for new tax credits to help small businesses. And this health savings account, a personal account that you can take with you from job to job. Eric, your thoughts on that first.
I think the idea here is twofold, and it's along the right directions. One is to allow a portability in the health insurance coverage that people have and the resources they have to provide for their health services. Right now, if someone leaves a job, their health insurance was provided by their employer, and they can't take that with them. And oftentimes, that is a source of people losing their health insurance. Moreover, for particularly many small businesses, they can't afford to offer health insurance. And so many of the uncovered workers are people in small businesses that don't provide them. The other thing is that one of the things that needs to be done in the health service sector is to introduce some incentives both for patients and for doctors to look at the economic consequences. So a plan where people are encouraged because the money comes out of their own health savings account to provide for health services to be more mindful of the services that are being demanded by them is a good step in the right direction for some reform in the health sector of the economy.
Ted, your thoughts?
My brief thoughts are these. First, the problem of portability, that is the fact that you can't carry your insurance easily from employer to employer, is a problem. But the answer need not be health savings accounts. Second,
What's wrong with them?
Well, my view is it's the worst idea introduced in health insurance in the last 50 years.
Because?
Individualizing savings for health care acts as if buying health care is something like buying groceries. The thing you're most concerned about in health care are two things. One is early prevention, and two, catastrophe. I'm all for catastrophic health insurance for everybody, but individualizing most of the expenses before catastrophe is, in my view, wrongheaded in the following important way. When you bear the cost of going to the doctor or going to the hospital, lower-income people tend to use it less, and higher-income people tend to use it more. It's not that it has no effect, that it's got a perverse effect. It discourages prevention. There's lots more to be said, but other than that, it's a wonderful idea.
I just want to quickly touch on the tax code. Last night, the president called for a bipartisan effort to simplify the federal tax code. What do you think it means, and what do you think the effect will be?
Anyone who believes that we're about to simplify the tax code in a major way, I think, is in for disappointment. It might be a code word, might, and I emphasize that. It might be a code word for what he did not emphasize last night, which is his conviction that he thinks a much lower rate of tax and perhaps a flat tax is the right thing to do and making more permanent the cuts that he had in mind earlier. But because of the fiscal situation in the United States where the deficit is such a prominent feature of our present fiscal arrangements, I doubt that he wanted to put emphasis upon that. So this was a vague reference to an aspiration which many people have had and many people have tried to do and nobody's been successful at.
Eric, any chance that a flat tax or a national sales tax would ever pass in a highly partisan Washington?
I think both a national sales tax or a flat tax would be very difficult at best to pass politically. And indeed, I think the president's plans and goals on that are a bit more modest in that details that he's released after the report have talked about the creation of a bipartisan commission on tax reform to look at ways to make the system more efficient, to better promote economic growth, also fairer and simpler. But Ted makes a good point. In our very complicated economy with very complicated financial markets, simplicity, as oftentimes people talk about, is very difficult to achieve.
At any rate, you can't go wrong saying simplify the tax code at a national political convention. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Robin.
Eric Engen from the American Enterprise Institute, Ted Marmer from Yale University.
Coming up, some last thoughts on the RNC. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
U.S. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao told us this week that good jobs were being added in the construction and healthcare industries. This provoked David True of Rochester, Massachusetts, to write, "It's obvious that the secretary, like most members of the president's cabinet, doesn't have a clue as to what's happening in the real world. Construction jobs are well paid for some, not so well for others, and they last for the duration of the project. Then it's back to the unemployment line. Not everyone can work in healthcare-related fields, and nurses are fighting to maintain decent working conditions. Get real."
We also spoke this week to retired General Tony McPeak. He responded to comments made by Vice President Cheney and Congressman Zell Miller about John Kerry's fitness to be commander and chief. Peter Leck of Providence, Rhode Island, noted, "To my recollection, he did not answer even one of the questions put to him. All he did on most occasions was refer to you or the listener's sense of judgment and loaded his statements with nonspecifics. General McPeak was to be the Democrats' response to their statements, but he did nothing, in my opinion, to bolster Kerry's stand on anything at all. I'm still a very undecided voter, and the general brought me no closer to making a decision."
Carl Martin of Medford, Massachusetts, called our listener line with this gripe about the amount of coverage of the Republican National Convention during yesterday's show.
Apparently, there's no war in Iraq, by what I've heard, both on the program and on the news summaries that interrupt it, and nothing about the Nepalese, nothing about Israel, important issues that seem to undermine the claims made in the convention by conservatives that we live in a safe world.
During our interview with Democrat-turned-Republican comedian Dennis Miller, we asked him about concerns that the Bush administration had turned away from pursuing Osama bin Laden to focus on Iraq. We asked Miller, "When is the last time you heard President Bush mention Osama bin Laden?" And Miller told us, "Where is Al-Qaedaville?" This provoked Gary Cohen of Philadelphia to write, "Call him back and tell him Al-Qaedaville is in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, not in Iraq. Saddam Hussein would never let Osama get in his way, let alone operate out of his kingdom. Bush lied to get us over there. And now we are stretched so thin that Osama is laughing his sorry ass off. I am heartsick for every life lost in this war and angry because it was for nothing."
And finally, Sarah Reed of St. Louis, Missouri, took issue with Boston Globe pop culture columnist Renee Graham on the lineup of pop artists performing at the Republican National Convention. Sarah writes, "A number of the performers are talented, imaginative Christian bands. Simply because a band isn't identified by Renee Graham as being a big name, it doesn't mean that Renee's eye-rolling is justified."
Jason from New Hampshire wanted to know what the music was that we played following that segment. Well, it was Watcher by Dr. Dre from the CD 2001 Instrumental.
As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at WNYC in New York.
It's Here and Now.
Well, as President Bush made his case for re-election, there was another race going on at Madison Square Garden this week, jockeying for position for 2008. Ben Smith is a columnist for the New York Observer. He's compiled a list of the rising stars of the Republican Party. He joined me at Madison Square Garden this week as we went through that list, and I asked him first about a category he calls loyalists. Senator Bill Frist of Tennessee, Governor Bill Owens of Colorado, and Governor Jeb Bush of Florida. What's their presidential likelihood?
Well, these are the establishment guys, and each of them, and they all have problems, and they're all, I mean, other than Jeb Bush, they're pretty obscure. The National Review loves Bill Owens, but nobody's ever heard of him. Bill Frist was sort of, in a way, tapped, it looked like, for a while, as the successor by Karl Rove. He was installed as Senate Majority Leader, and he's done a terrible job, which hasn't really, you know, enhanced his prospects.
Yeah, and loyalists because?
Because they really are out of the Bush family or the Bush, you know, organization.
How about the high priests? Tell us about them.
This is, you know, the religious wing of the party. Grover Norquist, who's a Republican strategist, says their issues are God, gays, and guns. And I mean, these are people who some very reliable Republican voters love, people like John Ashcroft, who are just utterly solid on issues like abortion.
Senator Rick Santorum is in there.
Yeah, and Rick Santorum is also talked about as a presidential contender.
And Senator Sam Brownback, who hosted an event this week in which he encouraged the attendees, mostly conservatives, to keep waging the culture war. So that kind of conversation is still going on, even though the more moderate face is being put on the podium. But would he be far too conservative for a candidate?
Well, the question is, would he be too conservative for a Republican primary? And it's the same kind of thing the Democrats went through this year. A lot of Democrats loved Howard Dean but felt he was too liberal to win in the general election.
Let's move on to what you call the Metro conservatives, or the RINOs, Republicans in name only, too, as
yeah,
you say.
That's what their enemies call them.
Some other conservative Republicans out in the heartland. But these are the ones whose names really seem to rise to the top in most people's minds. You know, Rudy Giuliani, Arizona Senator John McCain. Let's talk about McCain. It certainly looked like he was running this week.
Yeah, and the people around him all say that, I mean, will tell you privately that they think he has a shot. They don't think he's too old. They don't think the health problems he's had in the past are gonna recur. And he's the most popular politician in America.
More popular than Rudy Giuliani?
Maybe I should rephrase that. He's the best liked. Rudy Giuliani has more negatives than John McCain.
Okay. How about Governor George Pataki? There's a lot being made of the fact that both he and Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney seem to be perceived here as kind of trolling. What's the sense of either of them?
Well, Pataki, who I'm much more familiar with as a New York reporter, sure is. I mean, he's been very quietly behind the scenes, raised $10 million for George Bush's campaign. He's organized this elaborate social scene here for delegates, what you need is a Pataki pass, and that's what people are trying to get.
Now, you call these Metro conservatives, as we said, those that are considered by many in the party to be left of the Democrats, but you include Mitt Romney, whose state legalized gay marriage, but who was very much against it. Why would you include him as a lefty?
Yeah, you're right. The categories fall apart a little. I mean, I guess he's a cult. He's, yeah, he shouldn't
yeah,
be in there.
He shouldn't be in there. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
But what are his chances?
He's a very attractive guy. He gave a very good speech. He attacked Kerry without seeming like an attack dog, which is a tough line to walk, and a lot of them seem to cross it.
The Metro Conservatives also includes Arnold Schwarzenegger, Christine Todd Whitman. Any chance? Maybe vice president?
You know, people talk about her coming back, and she and Bill Weld, the former Massachusetts governor, both this week told me this very funny thing, which was sort of, oh, yeah, you know, I'll have big announcements in the future, but don't ask me till November 3rd. Give me a call on November 3rd. Both of them certainly see themselves as players still.
Two other categories, the neocons and the paleocons. Neocons include Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, paleocons, Pat Buchanan, Grover Norquist. What's the difference between the two?
I mean, it's partly cultural. The neocons, a lot of them are ex-liberals. They're what used to be called kind of the non-communist left, the anti-communist left, whose real allegiance is to a hawkish foreign policy and who've increasingly become a Republican group. They used to be right-wing Democrats, which is a wing of the party that no longer exists.
In some cases. And paleocon?
And the paleocons are the William F. Buckleys and Pat Buchanans of the world who are still fighting for a Republican party that you're not seeing on display at this convention.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben Smith, before we go, do me a favor. Tick off the top five, those who are considered by people here to really be possible candidates.
I think you'd have to start with Rudy in a way, just because of his star power this week. It's unbelievable. Had the crush of media and the delegates, and everybody wants to touch the hem of his robe, and people cry when they come up to him and talk to him. And he is his own worst enemy and has been known to destroy himself at various times in his career. But if he can manage not to do that, he's going to be a tough guy to beat. McCain, who remains incredibly popular, though maybe not so much with Republicans. You might want to include Bill Owens, the governor of Colorado. You know, his problem is that nobody's ever heard of him, but conservative establishment's very impressed with some of the policy stuff he's done. You got to include Jeb Bush, although, well, if his brother loses, it seems unlikely that the party would want to nominate the loser's brother. And if his brother wins, there's something a little unseemly about succession.
And who else?
I guess I'd give the fifth slot. You know, could go to a lot of people, but why not Bill Frist, who's got a great story. You know, he's a doctor. He's an actual compassionate conservative to the extent that he's gone to Africa and fought AIDS. And if he can manage to, you know, give a good speech and operate effectively in Washington, neither of which he's really shown he can do.
Well, Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ben Smith is a columnist for the New York Observer. I spoke with him from Madison Square Garden earlier this week. Well, the Republican convention is over, and not a moment too soon. For those New Yorkers who have run out of patience, some reporters who have run out of questions that might get answers, as you'll hear, and for politicians running out of gas. Here are some sounds from the edit floor from the week past. Senator Frist, what do you think about the talk here about you as a candidate in 2008?
A lot of talk. I'm focused on supporting President Bush and being the very best majority leader I possibly can.
Have people been coming up to you with aches and pains?
Everybody does. You can hear my voice right now. My voice is gone. I'm looking for a good doctor right now.
You are one.
I know it. I need to do a transplant on my voice box.
Pat Boone.
Yes.
I don't suppose you could sing any April Love for me.
I tell you, I've talked myself hoarse. April Love is for the very young.
Rainbow City, Alabama. My husband's an alternate delegate. We brought our four children and a babysitter. It's fun. The protesters have been a little intimidating at times, but we've gotten through that too. We've had a wonderful time.
This is costing us a fortune, too.
It's costing us a fortune. It's a huge... What is most upsetting to me as a New Yorker is that it's a blatant capitalization on what happened here on September 11th. And for a party that has...
His friends respect him. His enemies fear him. They don't know what's going to happen. That's why we have the comfort, the safety, the security of this great nation with homeland security and the security you see enacted right here to protect us, to give us the comfort of going about our daily duties, enjoying the freedoms of this great nation called America.
Don King here on the Tony Snow Show. I'm just trying to catch my breath.
Liz Cheney, it was your daughter who barked at a convention?
Yeah, it was actually in 2000, and she developed a real skill for barking and decided to bark at the press corps. So during the closing prayer, actually, we heard a noise and we said, my God, there's a dog in here. And then we realized it wasn't a dog, it was just Elizabeth. So.
I'm at the moment unfurling flags to pass them out. This is a very patriotic crowd, obviously, and I think they're proud to have flags on such an important evening to display.
This is a Republican with an attitude. It was a gift given to me. this was a gift from my daughter who sits right here. And let's see, my hat is classic of is Texas gaudy.
Well, we make a group of talking mice, and we feel the election is turning into a real rat race. And we have a George Bush mouse and a John Kerry mouse and an Arnold mouse. Would you like to hear what he says?
Sure.
Okay.
California, here I come.
We have Hannity and Combs tonight. How great is my lineup if I have you? Zell Miller's going to be on Hannity and Combs, and I have First Lady Laura Bush. How great is that?
Oh, well, you could have just said Laura Bush, and that would have been the show.
You know, Senator, the one thing that you have taught me is this need for intellectual honesty and
Mo Rocca appearing every night with Larry King, trolling the convention floor, looking for God knows what. What are you finding?
At the RNC here in the gift bags, you have 10 copies of the Passion of the Christ DVD, one for yourself, 9 for your godless friends and coworkers, a whole roll of school vouchers, which I think is really terrific. These parties are treating us like such idiots, as if we can only, over the course of 4 days, handle one message. In the DNC, it being that John Kerry served in Vietnam, and in this one, that hordes of Islamofascists are about to descend and murder us all.
Sounds from the RNC from the week past. Special thanks today to our colleagues at WNYC, Carrie Pitkin, John Keefe, Neil Golub, and Bill O'Neill, who helped produce today's coverage from New York.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
Tune into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.